Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. University College London says that lifting weights or any resistance exercise makes your nervous system stronger. Published in the Journal of Neuroscience. That's good to know, so gym goers may be frustrated when they don't see results from weightlifting right away, but their efforts are not in vain. The first few weeks of training for strength is strengthening your nervous system, not muscles. That's according to newest research. Because the brain orchestrates movement via two major neural highways descending to the spinal column and the corticospinal tract, and is thought to be the dominant pathway. Anyhow, it's all good. Lift your weights and have a stronger nervous system, as well as muscles. We have a lot to share on health and healing today, but also I've had a lot of calls and emails of people who are very concerned of what happens in our society today on many different fronts. A lot of people are calling saying, what do? I don't have a job to go back to. You know, I was in quarantine and my company closed down that I work with. I don't have other skills. You know, I maxed out on my credit cards. I can't even afford to buy gas or food. I'm getting a lot of that. Others are saying, what's going on in the streets? Peaceful demonstrations? Yes. Burning down people's businesses, mainly people of color? People of color burning down people of color's businesses. How in the hell does that make any sense? How does that help what all of our efforts collectively and unity towards against racism, which any responsible and reasonable and spiritual person agrees with? But how do you step over that line from trying to get America's conscience raised again, at least in those where it may not have, but also realize it's already been raised and is fully applicable in the vast majority of Americans every single day? We've had peace and harmony. We had coexistence. We have a lot of gains that have been made, no more so than in college and university campuses where diversity is it's more important than any subject taught, more important than any professor. So where are we at? People are concerned because they see this escalating. They don't know what the outcome could be, and they don't know who's behind it. Okay, that's a completely understandable concern of a lot of people. Then you have the idea that people are terrified of the coronavirus. They hear one thing from the government, but then if they listen to this program, we've been deconstructing every single argument and talking about natural immunity by building your body and building your strength. And I wrote a book on the immune system. I did a documentary on the immune system, Supercharge Your Immune System. So it's something I'm very familiar with because in my entire 53-year career of helping people, it's all based upon the immune system. So that's why not a single person that we've worked with since this has gone on, including in Texas at our anti-aging study, got sick. So what does it mean when we have more cases and they're not giving it in proper context? I'll discuss that. Today, I'll deconstruct some more myths today. Also, where are we going? Where are we going with global warming? The hottest day in the Arctic's history was just a week ago, 100 degrees, and 100 miles north of the Arctic Circle. And now fires are all over that area because it's drying out all forms of the boreal force, which is the largest force in the world, covering the whole top of the world. And when that dries out and the frozen tundra under it falls, we will see the most rapid rise in global warming imaginable. There is no accurate mathematical model. Even when I sat with Guy McPherson and others, Kevin Hester, and leading climatologists, and we started looking at mathematical models, what could be predicted? It's happening now. The fact that we had a 100-degree day in the Arctic, it's right now. And it's going to accelerate so damn fast that there are whole places in the world where you will not be able to sustain life or grow crops. right now. We're not talking about the future. I just wrote an article on this. I read the article. I don't know if you had a chance to listen on the program on Friday when I read the article, but if you didn't, it's posted on PRN.fm. It's the latest article, and it's about the future, you know, how bad it's going to get, you know, that we're coming to the end. No, we're past the end. We're already beyond the end. We're in so many positive feedback loops. Go back 10 years. Do you remember 10 years ago I did a series of one-hour specials on PRN and WBAI? And those specials dealt with the 12 tipping points. And each tipping point, I said, if we don't get ahead of this and make changes now, it will tip. And when it tips, it goes into a positive feedback loop. So one bad thing, like, for example, not having ice in the Arctic, that then doesn't allow the sun to reflect back off and harmlessly the sun rays off the ice. So when the ice melts, the rays go into the water to a shallow 500, 700 foot depth, and they warm up the bottom. And the bottom is what's holding unlimited, uncountable, incalculable quadrillion trillions of methane bubbles. When those methane bubbles are released, they have anywhere from a 23 to 52 times greater impact than carbon dioxide. So what happens is a positive feedback loop. So it gets warmer. That gets rid of the ice. Then you start melting the methane. That's the second feedback loop. That releases more methane. More methane, more global warming. More global warming, more methane. More methane, more global warming. And now your great reservoirs of water in the glaciers all over the world, the great Himalayan glaciers, holding the largest amount of water that feeds seven immense rivers that provide water to over 2 billion people, including in China and Vietnam, in India, Myanmar, all these countries. Where do you think their water comes from? Do you know there's not a drop of water that goes from the Amazon into the ocean anymore? Nor, for that matter, the Nile. So we're running out of water where we need it because of the glaciers. So when the sun hits mountain ice pack, it bounces back, harmless, and melts it gradually over, let's say, a 4 or 5 month period. But when that snow is gone because of global warming, it hits the rock, the mountain rock, the face of the rock, and it warms it up. And then rock holds heat, just like it's hotter in Manhattan than it is, let's say, in Kingston, New York, because the density of concrete and steel holds the heat, so the actual ambient air is much hotter. That's why when I would go out sometimes to be walking back from my office at 1 o'clock in the morning to my apartment, it would be hot. I mean, really hot, where if I were in the suburbs, it would be cooler. So now imagine that a whole mountain range is now warming up. So it just keeps warming down. So when snow hits it, it's not sticking. So now where's the water supposed to come for 39 million people going clear out this, all of Nevada and down through Arizona, over through California to give them their water? Or the Sierra Nevadas, where the mountains of Nevada and where it used to provide a 450-plus mile canal to take that water. We've now started right now, as we're speaking, it was 4 weeks ago, they officially stated we're in the longest drought in American history. It could go on for anywhere from 40 to 400 years. So thinking about getting out of California or thinking of moving to California, big mistake. Because the politicians are going to look what keeps them in office and calms the people. Could you imagine if there was a politician in California that told you the truth about how unsustainable California was? The fires are going to get worse, the mudslides worse, the ocean acidification worse, everything's worse. 100 million trees dead because of global warming out there, and then the beetles infest it, and then it's all tinder for the fires? Well, you'd leave the state. Any reasonable, responsible person would. But not if everyone tells you everything's okay. So we have people doing just the opposite. They're moving to Miami Beach and the beaches of America. Clear up the East Coastline, clear up the West Coastline. So is it the public who are intentionally ignorant because of intentional neglect. They don't want to know the truth because it'll interfere with their desires or wishes. So you see, everybody's engaged in some form of denialism. It doesn't matter what you want to not do. Nature's going to come ahead and unfortunately cause devastation everywhere. So there are a lot of things people are concerned about. I'm going to address as many of them as I can today. And also then we're going to hear from Professor Jonathan Haidt about the whole culture of the stunning fragility and the vindictive political correctness of today's students. Not all students, maybe anywhere from 5 to 10% of students, but all you have to have as a dysfunctional, radicalized minority to get all the attention, to suck out all the media in the room as if they're the only voices out there. They're not. For every one of the voices who claim that all the police are racist and hence they're all pigs and hence, what was the chant that I heard? Everybody was chanting it, thousands of people. You know, what do we want? Dead cops. When do we want them now? Now stop for a moment and think about that. Over 50% of those police are minorities. Many of them are very proud of the fact that they graduated from the police academy and they're there to serve. Many of them come from families where they've had generations of police. Not armored body police, not hyped on steroids, not post-traumatic stress disorder out of Iraq and Afghanistan or coming back who are hair triggered and shouldn't be in any capacity to leave because they have to be helped. They need help. They don't and shouldn't be put into a, given the responsibility of being given a gun, put into a position like a SWAT team. No, these are people who've been there for generations. So yes, you have a percentage of them who are mentally incapacitated by life events, including trauma, and they shouldn't be in a position to be a police officer. And so you're out there attacking someone who could save your life. So let's just take away the cops. That's what you want, right? Get rid of the cops. Okay, then there's no one taking your 911 calls, going to respond to them. No one going to stop any conflict. No rapes, no murders, no shootings, no abuse, no domestic abuse. Within 4 weeks, we would descend into the type of chaos that you saw at the end of the Roman Empire. Think about what you do when you condemn everyone for the wrongful actions, the irresponsible and reprehensible actions of a small percentage. And we're not doing that type of thinking. We're responding out of emotion. We're not using reason. We're using emotional reaction, self-righteous indignation, and all the things that are locked and loaded in our subconscious epigenetic conditioned mind to strike like a spitting cobra because we feel so frustrated by something in our lives that this is just the latest way we can express it. That's my way to express it. That's not constructive. It is not positive. It does not unite, solve problems, and have a better world and an outcome because of the wiser mind, the wiser men and women coming forward to say, yeah, we've been here all along. Let us offer our input. I don't want a screaming, in-your-face, 16-year-old spoiled brat from Connecticut telling me or anyone else by virtue shaming how we should respond to an issue when they haven't even responded to their life yet. So we're going to hear from Jonathan Haidt today on that. And then we're going to hear from Brett Weinstein. Now, mind you, he's testifying under oath before Congress about he, as a liberal, the ultimate liberal professor, and his wife, liberal professor at Evergreen, he was the most respected and loved professor in the college. But it wasn't any of the students in the college to protest. It was agitators outside, and they went after him. I mean, physically, to hurt him, and yelling down until they got him out of it. He and his wife got him out. And he said, this is just the beginning. And he was right. And this is just the beginning. What we're seeing now is worse than coronavirus. It's going to spread everywhere. Well, there will be only one truth, and that will be their truth, and it'll be legislated. And watch what happens once you're told what you cannot say, cannot write, cannot read, the platforms you cannot be on, the truths you cannot know. That's called fascism. And that's where we're at right now. But to give the most important opinion about hygiene today, George Carlin. Yeah, that'll lighten it up a bit. So let's start. As you see, we take on all the issues, and our whole objective is to empower people with a higher conscious level of thinking, a deeper understanding and sensitivity to the nature of human beings and how we can come together if we choose to. We can sit together, we can discuss together, we can argue together without demeanment. And there's still those of us in the room. We just haven't been heard from yet. So let's get out and start doing some resistance exercise. And the older you are, the more resistance exercise you should get involved with, because it helps your muscles and helps keep your muscle mass. And that is important. Also, from Isfahan University of Medical Sciences in Iran, published in the peer journal Phytotherapy Research, this study found that garlic increased the ability for rheumatoid arthritis symptoms to be alleviated. So the more garlic you take, the less arthritic symptoms you manifest. That's good. So eat garlic. Now, there's a lot of ways of eating garlic, but 2.5 grams, that's a small amount of garlic, like a teaspoon of garlic a day. It can lower your C-reactive protein level. That protects you from a heart attack. It involves itself with serum tumor necrosis factor alpha. So all the good things that it can do, turning off biomarkers of inflammation all over the body. So garlic, one teaspoon of garlic a day can turn inflammation away from the body. How about that? Also from the University of Limerick, which is in Ireland, comes a study that says, get this, ready? Healthy diet could reduce the risk of severe respiratory viral infections. Quote, a group of researchers, University of Limerick, have established a clear connection between a healthy diet and fighting inflammation linked to COVID-19. We were right all along. In fact, here's a challenge. Why don't you, or someone out there, allow a protocol of only healthy things in a assisted living center, meaning hyperbaric oxygen, ozone, intravenous nutrients, homeopathy, plant-based diet, juices, meditation, exercise, animal therapy. Yeah. And watch the people leave there healthy instead of going from an assisted living to a nursing home. Now, it's never been done. I'm putting the challenge out. I defy anyone to show that we can't reverse every disease there is. I mean ALS, everyone, improve them, slow it down, or reverse it. They're afraid. I remember when I contacted the head of the Pan Am Medical Organization, and I said, I'm willing to pay for 1,000 cancer patients who are terminally ill to undergo an alternative non-medical therapy. You choose the patients. You give those 100,000 or 1,000 patients on your end, your traditional end-of-life therapies. I'll give them holistic therapy, and then let's see which patients are alive and well at the end of a year, longer than any of them would normally be alive. They wouldn't do it. Of course they wouldn't do it. No one. Fritz Perls, the father Gestalt, said it best, a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. So what you don't want to know the outcome to, you don't ask the question. You don't open that door, because the truth in behind that door is greater than what you can handle with your limited comprehension of reality. So here it is. Limerick University is telling you, you want to deal with the COVID-19, the inflammation link and the role of nutrition in potential mitigation. That's the title of the article, and it's published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients. So one more, and yet this will not be seen anywhere in any of the suggestions in any of the newspapers anywhere. Yet there it is. By the way, Lady Harding's Medical College in India, published in the International Journal of Dermatology, says male pattern hair loss is linked to a decreased level of vitamin D. So, hey, men, increase your level of vitamin D, let's say 5,000 units a day. And what makes arteries age? Well, the study out of the University of Colorado says your gut bacteria and your diet. I'll make it simple. When you have bad arteries, you are going to have a heart outcome, a stroke, congestive heart failure, cardiomyopathy, a heart ischemic episode. You're going to have something go wrong, and you're going to survive or dead, one or the other. And when you eat meat, you damage your arteries. Sugar damages the arteries. Alcohol damages the arteries. Caffeine damages the arteries. Fried food, trans fat, damages the arteries. Arachidonic acid, the fat from meat, damages the arteries. But when you're eating healthy, clean foods that are rich in probiotics, you're creating a whole colony of good bacteria. So your diet and your bacteria, according to the University of Colorado, published in the journal, peer-reviewed journal of the American Heart Association of Hypertension, you're helping your arteries de-age. Remember, beets? De-age your arteries. Pomegranate? De-age your arteries. Rhubarb? De-age your arteries. Yeah, it's that simple, not complicated. And finally, from Odessa National Medical University in Ukraine, chili pepper, which is a traditional remedy for rheumatoid arthritis, really works. Another study published in the Journal of Phytopharmacology. Yeah, the functional food, chili pepper, cayenne pepper, is widely used as a spice, and especially in southern Ukraine. It's a natural remedy for a variety of illnesses, including rheumatoid arthritis. And they found out that it works big time. So that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go directly to a very wise person talking about why we have this mindset. Now, I'm going to take it further than him. I'm going to take it back on another discussion. I'm writing a commentary now. If you appreciated the commentary I just wrote and just gave you on a Monday this week, this one is a step beyond that. I'm putting the responsibility in no small measure on how we have a whole generation that lacks morals, manners, etiquette, respect for elders, respect for society as a whole, who think themselves idealists, but their ideals are one of retaliation and retribution, punishment, shaming, destruction. So their idea is, yeah, we want a better world, and you're not a part of it, unless you agree with us 100%. If you don't, then we're going to destroy you. So now the whole thing is everyone in the world is racist, and unless you belong to that group and that mindset, and then you're protected, and then you must go to the streets, then you must... No, that's insanity. That's just insanity. Do you realize behind the bad acting out are the parents who thought they were doing the right thing by buying their children love, these bubble-raised children? Because they're not all children. There are a lot of very decent children, a lot of very decent and noble and honorable college students who are going there to learn. Not these kids. And then take it back further. These are the policymakers and opinion leaders. Who benefits from all this? Ask yourself, who benefited from a 3-year fraud of Russia, Russia, Russia? Now, I can't stand a single thing that Trump has ever done. I'm critical of every single action he's done. It's all wrong. But had Hillary been elected, you would have known how deep the deep state goes and how much control they have over your lives. Now we know. They've shown themselves. So we went from Russia, Russia, Russia to COVID, COVID, COVID to racist, racist, racist. Behind all those, our group of power people, they benefit. The rest of us, we lose.
What we're seeing in the last few years is the rise of a particular subgroup that is extremely passionate morally about equality, about fighting racism, and that's all great. But they've adopted a way that is kind of vindictive, that is all about calling people out. So people are afraid of them. And it's not just the students. It's actually the professors, too. So even if it's only 5 or 10% on any campus, the fact that they can file charges against a professor.
Wow.
At NYU, we have a new bias response team. So any video I show, anything I say in class, if it offends a student, there's numbers all over in every bathroom urging them to call, report me. So that changes the way we teach. And then, as Frank said, if students aren't exposed to diverse ideas, then if somebody like Charles Murray comes, well, you know, he spoke at Middlebury 10 years ago and there was no big problem.
After his more controversial book. He's since then, his 2012 book, Coming Apart, which is, he was supposed to, much less controversial, that's what he was supposed to be speaking about.
Right, it's quoted in opinion columns of the New York Times all the time.
Left and right.
Yes, that's right.
And it's the biggest problem of our age. I mean, why did Trump win? It's the coming apart of the, by class.
It is a minority of students and it is a minority of schools. But they do set the tone. And at those schools where this is prevalent, it's really, really pronounced, and we're producing graduates who have little sense of the true ideological political diversity of American life. I went, within the last couple of years, want to be vague, to a very esteemed liberal arts college in the Northeast. And when I was there, the president had a dinner for me at the president's house, and all these faculty members went around the table and sang the praises of the school. And I heard about the affinity group they had for this group. I heard about XYZ. We got to the end. There were like 20 faculty members. At the end, they said, do you have any questions? And they were all boasting about what a diverse environment they had. And I had one question. I said, is there a group for Republican students? And they looked at me like it had never occurred to them. And there was one student there. And she said, I think there is, but they maybe have one member. Now, schools trip over themselves to get racial diversity. They give a lot of lip service to socioeconomic diversity, and some of them do better than others. But what about this whole other kind of diversity? How are we going to move forward as a country if many of our top schools are graduating kids who have no, who can't even begin to process how a human being could vote for Donald Trump? They need to understand. Right. Who voted for Donald Trump and why, and that they're not monsters.
I think the best analogy here is to understand what's happening with peanut allergies. Why are peanut allergies rising? They've been rising at an alarming rate since the 90s. And so what do? We, you know, I take my kids to school. We get these long lectures on how we can't have any peanut butter in school.
And if you bring, I go through the Senate, if you bring them, you're basically expelled.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a report came out last year. Do you know why peanut allergies are rising? Because we haven't exposed kids to peanuts. Right. That's the reason they're rising. So the new recommendation is you got to give kids peanuts early.
Right.
So this is what we've been doing.
It's
not even a metaphor. I mean, it's the exact same psychological process. So Nassim Taleb has this wonderful book called Anti-Fragile. Kids are anti-fragile. So if you're fragile, that means like, oh, if I knock this, it'll break. Don't knock it.
Right.
But anti-fragile, like your bones, your brain, your personality, you need challenges, you need setbacks. You need to experience exclusion and insult in order to make it to adulthood. And the biggest problem, I think, is the loss of unsupervised play. So Lenore Skenazy has been brilliant on this with her book, Free Range Kids. You know, in our childhoods, after school, we spent time where there was no adult around, but there was a real crime
wave. No after-school programming. Yeah, imagine that. Right. You just have to come home and kind of figure out how to keep yourself busy.
That's right. And so, but in the, you know, in the 80s, there was a real crime wave. There were anti-bullying measures. There was a fear of abduction. So for a variety of reasons, kids basically were never out of adult oversight. And now in many towns, you can get arrested if your kid goes to the park to play. Right. So, you know, we can't be too tough on these kids. We have deprived them of experience, in the name of keeping them safe and happy and comfortable, we've deprived them of uncomfortable experiences with their peers. Mm-hmm. There's always an adult around. And so they come to campus. This is the last chance we could possibly give young Americans to learn to work out their differences. Right. And we don't do it. We have more and more deans and processes and bias response teams so that there's always an adult to call in to settle the problem.
This is the, to use the jargon of today, this is the helicopter parent producing the bubble-wrapped kid.
Right.
And when I did my college book about admissions to elite schools and all that, the complaint I heard most often from deans of admission, from college presidents at the very top schools in terms of selectiveness, was that these kids arrive on campus and they are overachievers by every metric that college is using. And the phrase that sticks with me is one admissions dean said, I am always amazed by the stunning fragility of these kids, which is exactly what Jonathan was talking about. And so what do? We give them these safe spaces. We construct these affinity groups. And debate about that is so shut down. I wrote a column not long ago asking the question, all of these colleges that put so much effort into bringing in a diverse class, once those kids are on campus, what do they do to actually promote interactions so that you have diverse interactions and don't affinity groups, don't safe spaces, don't those sort of work in the opposite direction. I was forwarded tweets where people were saying things like, I never knew Frank Bruni was such a racist. I was a racist because... So you asked how do Jonathan's colleagues react to him. When I talk to people in higher education, he's a hero because he's bringing up stuff about free speech and ideological diversity that they know needs to be bring. But they won't say that in the public square, or they won't say the same things he's saying because they're so worried about a kind of shaming that the left right now, sadly, seems to specialize in.
Yeah, and I think this is really crucial. Mark Lilla had a piece in the New York Times right after the election on the problem of identity politics and how this may have alienated a lot of people and contributed to Trump's victory. And the response from many academics was ferocious. One of his colleagues at Columbia, within a few days, had some essay basically linking him to the Ku Klux Klan. But here's the point. So Lilla comes back with this brilliant point. He says, that's a slur, not an argument. And once he said that, I realized, oh, my God, that is exactly what has been happening to me. I've been saying some pretty provocative things, beginning with an Atlantic article with Greg Lukianoff, and I keep looking on the internet for people who will respond to it, and pretty much nobody's arguing against me for anything I say. But I do get a lot of people basically saying I'm a white male or I somehow am winking at racism, something like that. So young people who go through these colleges, they're exposed to a rhetorical training that prevents them from learning how to engage. They're trained carefully in how to basically discredit your opponent. Slur. Right. They learn to slur. They do not learn to argue.
So go look at the tape from Middlebury, and that's exactly what you see. You see students with their backs turned, and they're chanting slurs. They're not having an intellectual argument.
And then when I was on college campus, I was active in the Israel debate about the peace process. And when I speak to students today on campus, they say the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions debate about boycotting Israel, getting campuses to boycott Israel, it's no longer just between those who support one policy on Israel and those who oppose another policy on Israel, which it was like when I was going to college. Now those who are hostile to Israel or U.S. policy towards Israel are joined by almost like a coalition of all these different factions who know nothing about the issue, but they all lock arms?
Mm-hmm. That's right. So, because the key to the new morality is a method of looking at society and looking in terms of power and privilege. So the old idea of an education is come to campus, we're going to teach you lots of perspectives that you can use, you know, let's look at poverty. What would an economist say? You know, what would a Marxist say? We used to learn a lot of perspectives to look at a single problem. What's happening now is some students, again, it's only in a few departments, but they're learning one perspective to look at everything. And so you start, so there's a good kind of identity politics, which is, you know, if black people are being denied rights, let's fight for their rights. That's the good kind. But there's a bad kind, which is to train students, to train young people to say, let's divide everybody up by their race and gender and other categories. We'll assign them moral merit based on their level of privilege is bad and victimhood is good. Okay, now let's look at everything through this lens. Israel, the Palestinians are the victims. So therefore, they are the good and the Jews or the Israelis are the bad. Right. So it's this one totalizing perspective. All social problems get reduced to this simple framework. I think we're doing them a disservice. I think we're actually making students less wise.
Right? Yeah, you know what I also see on campuses, Dan, is students who are not part of, who don't have the party line down pat. They really feel muffled. For some reason, frequently when I've been on campuses, I will have a student guide or I'll end up with a student who gives some sort of tell that he or she is religious. Mm-hmm. And I'll say to that person, and I'm not a particularly religious person in the way we define it in this country, but I believe fervently in freedom along those lines. And I'll say to that student, how comfortable do you feel bringing up your religion or God in class? Or in the fraternity house or the sorority house, whatever. And always this sort of, they're so happy I asked the question. They said, you know, I almost never talk about it. That's so wrong. And you mentioned Israel. I think if you're an Israel supporter, you probably bite your tongue more than you do shout it out.
Right. Keep your head down.
And you shouldn't have to do that.
Right.
But before we leave, one thing I don't think we've said loudly and clearly enough is when people on the left, or whatever, however you want to, when they try to shut down this debate, do they not realize that Donald Trump's election in 2016 is partly the fruit of those sorts of actions? I know so many people who flirted with voting for Trump, who did vote for Trump, who were responding to his destruction of a kind of political correctness that they find oppressive. And so there's a real relevance to what we're talking about today on campus and who's governing our country right now. And I don't think the people on the left have read wrestled adequately with that.
And the reason is because you have to see this not as a practical method of addressing problems. It's the dawn of a new religion. And I study moral psychology as though it's religion, politics, even sports tribalism. They're all manifestations of a tribalism. And I think we see this in the Charles Murray case very clearly. I just watched the video again today before coming here. And at the end, when the administrators say, okay, we're going to move the talk, and some of the screaming, off campus,
right.
Off campus. And then he says to another venue on campus, and they scream. Because what you have to see
the
is campus the
campus, is, their
is there? It's a church,
yeah.
That's right.
Wow.
And you cannot have blasphemy on campus. And so the best way to understand what happened, I think, is an auto de fe. It's a religious rite coming together to punish the sinner, to punish the devil, and to reaffirm our community.
Those are just some of the thoughts. We're going to be having other people from the educational system giving us their perspective of what's going on with our teaching, the curriculum, the power on the campus, the fear, the absolute out-and-out fear that professors have of their students, where they feel that if they say anything that could offend them, suddenly they will be out of a job, even if they're tenured. And it's happening. I'd like your thoughts on this. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Because behind this, behind what any responsible, reasonable person would say is wrong, the killing of any person who shouldn't be killed, meaning they're not a threat, they shouldn't be killed, they shouldn't be stop and frisk. I've made my points many times on what I believe we should do as a substitute to replace the existing system, where we still have police, but we have police that are there to maintain a sense of a peace within a neighborhood. Therefore, the police come from the neighborhood, all right? And they spend time only in that neighborhood. I believe that we would see a tremendous difference in the nature of violence and the ability to modify behavior so it doesn't get to the point where someone either gets arrested or gets hurt, shot in any way that is wrong. And so, but that's a secondary nature. I'm pulling back far enough where I believe that everything today is being controlled by the deep state. And the media is the perfect example because it. When was the last time you heard a story from the New York Times, Washington Post, or CNN where they went in to a burned-out neighborhood in Minneapolis where you had over 400 businesses, over 90%, 95% of those businesses were from minority residents, and said, tell us your story, to hear what it's like to work your whole life, to have a little business in a neighborhood, and now it's gone. And there's no insurance, and your whole life is wiped out as far as where do you go from here? And there's no fundraising. There's no money coming their way. There's no apology. They're simply invisible. Then it tells me there's a hidden agenda beyond the obvious. So we're looking out here like an illusionist. Illusionist is showing us the coin in the right hand when they've already got the coin in their left hand, the other coin. So we have been distracted by what would make anyone outraged, and rightly so, but there's a deeper agenda, power. I'd like your thoughts. 888-874-4888. And by the way, for the thousands of people who were not able to get to my webinar because we were packed, and I'm sorry about that, we did as much as we could, we have reposted it so people can go there and download it and you'll get the whole 6 hours. It was a 6 hour on what to do, where to go, and where the safest places are, the healthiest places are, the most progressive places are in the world, country by country, state by state, county within states, and what are the best jobs, the worst jobs. Even if you're in college now, I give you the programs are going to be obsolete by the time you graduate. You're not going to be able to have a job. Automation, transhumanism, I'm all by the way. I don't have time today, but I'm also going to give you the newest. They've already 15 different countries. Different countries have agreed to now have a COVID passport. And it's coming where you will have to be taking first a completely false test. And by the way, for our sister station, WBAI, last night on the Progressive Commentary Hour, I had Celia Farber, one of the finest, most courageous, intelligent, investigative journalists of the last 40 years. And she was on for the whole hour talking about the fraud of the current antibody test. And I would concur because I also knew and filmed many times the man who invented it, Professor Curry Mullis, or Dr. Curry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize in 1996 in chemistry for the PCR. And he said, don't use it to see if a person has AIDS throughout their body, HIV throughout their body. And yet that's exactly what Fauci did. And he would say today, don't use it to determine if a person has, you know, COVID virus throughout their body. And that's exactly what they're doing. And I've got study after study after study showing that that antibody test is inaccurate. So you're going to hear that program tomorrow on WBAI. It's a really, really enlightening program. In any case, I'd like to hear what you have to say. So you can go to prn.fm if you want to get the information on that webinar, because right now, even today, I get a call from New York City that four businesses on the Upper West Side that have been there for years and years have closed permanently. And my brother told me that where we had 24% of all small businesses closed in all five boroughs, and he would know more than any other person in New York because he's headed the small business group to as a volunteer for all these years to help people argue their case for lower rents and not paying the landlords' real estate taxes before councils, etc. He said now it's going to be up an additional 40%. Now that's 40 on top of 24, or 64% of all businesses in the boroughs are gone, dead, not coming back ever. So for those of you who are waiting, look up, look ahead, look around. New York is not the place for anyone to live unless you're very rich. All right? Get out of it. It's a corrupt cesspool. It used to be the cultural, intellectual, dynamic, working middle class, all class neighborhoods. There wouldn't have been a better place I could find to live and spend my adult life. Today, no. Moving on. Other places, safer, nicer, and still progressive people, and healthier places, getting out of harm's way. Okay? Now, we're going to go to a professor. Listen carefully what he's saying. He's saying this under oath before Congress because he saw what happens when the mob comes and you think you can reason with them. You want to communicate with them. You want to have a civil discourse with them. And not one of the students, and almost all black students, were participating. In fact, his own black students defended him, all of them, and they were attacked the worst. So this is the future. This is now, and this is just a heads up of what's going to be happening everywhere.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to address you. Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the day 50 Evergreen students, students that I had never met, disrupted my class, accusing me of racism and demanding my resignation. I tried to reason with them. I felt no fear because I knew that whatever my failings might be, bigotry was not among them. At that moment, I felt sure I could reach them. I also felt a moral obligation to try. That racism squanders human potential and erodes human dignity offends me. I am also well-versed in the evolutionary logic that makes racism durable. I should have had no trouble establishing common ground. Their response surprised me. It would take months for me to fully understand what had happened. The protesters had no apparent interest in the very dialogue they seemed to invite. I was even more surprised by the protesters' fervor in shouting down my actual students, some of whom had known me for years. The cruelty and derision reserved for students of color who spoke in my defense was particularly troubling. If not discussion, what did they want? I was one of Evergreen's most popular professors. I had Evergreen's version of tenure. Did they really think they could force my resignation based on a meritless accusation? They did think that, and they were right. What I had not counted on was their alliance with Evergreen's new president. Though the protesters openly humiliated him, the president of the college partnered with the mob in private, handing them concession after concession. We know this because the rioters filmed everything and proudly uploaded it. In one particularly telling video, the president calmly discusses with the leaders of the protest a demand to target STEM faculty based on the empty assertion that scientists are particularly prone to bias. In that same video, the president speaks of his plan for those who resist the new order. Bring them in, train him, and if it doesn't take, sanction them. He invites his partners to hold him to it. On the second day of unrest, the police chief called me. Rioters were stopping traffic and searching for someone car to car. The chief believed they were searching for me. She was worried for my safety and helpless to protect me, as the president had ordered her force to stand down. What would have transpired if the rioters had found me? I still don't know, and I strongly suspect they don't either. The protest at my class did not emerge out of the blue in May of 2017. 1 year earlier, I stood up and spoke in opposition to a dangerous proposal, one that threatened to establish a racial hierarchy amongst faculty. To those who have not faced something similar, this likely sounds hyperbolic. But one can now advance such policies and almost certainly succeed in passing them if they are properly draped in weaponized terminology. Equity, for example, has taken on special properties. If a person opposes an equity proposal, those advancing the proposal are secure in asserting that the person is motivated by opposition to racial equity itself. In other words, they are racist. My opposition to that first equity proposal was voiced to my colleagues with no students present. Demands for my resignation 1 year later, in May of 2017, were not the result of organic student confusion. They were payback for violating a de facto code of faculty conduct in which one's right to speak is now dictated by adherence to an ascendant orthodoxy in which one's race, gender, and sexual orientation are paramount. The students were on a mission. They were unwitting tools of a witting movement. This committee should take my tale as cautionary. Is there a free speech crisis on college campuses? One can certainly make that argument, but that portrayal is at least as misleading as it is informative. What is occurring on college campuses is about power and control. Speech is impeded as a last resort, used when people or groups fail to self-censor in response to a threat of crippling stigma and the destruction of their capacity to earn. These tools are being used to unhook the values that bind us together as a nation: equal protection under the law, the presumption of innocence, a free marketplace of ideas, the concept that people should be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin. Yes, even that core tenet of the civil rights movement is being dismantled. Am I alleging a conspiracy? No. What I have seen functions much more like a cult, in which the purpose is only understood by the leaders, and the rest have been seduced into a carefully architected fiction. Most of the people involved in this movement earnestly believe that they are acting nobly to end oppression. Only the leaders understand that the true goal is to turn the tables of oppression. Something is seriously and dangerously amiss. At this moment in history, the center does not hold. Partisan polarization and political corruption have rendered government ineffective, predatory, and often cruelly indifferent to the suffering of American citizens. Tribalism is the natural result. Evergreen's public meltdown placed me in the eye of the storm and cast me into the spotlight. As a member of the intellectual dark web, I find myself at the vanguard of an emerging, non-ideological, non-partisan movement. Along with the Heterodox Academy and the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, we are fighting to restore civility and respect for competing perspectives. The electorate is starved for honest debate and for the good governance that follows from it. My advice to this body is to put the nation and its core values ahead of partisanship and join us in the center to end this cultish power grab and return us to a forward path as a nation. I look forward to your questions.
What has been the reaction to what happened to you, both on campus and off campus? Have any changes been made?
The campus has doubled down on every foolish idea it was pursuing and has gotten itself into very serious financial trouble for lack of students, which I should tell you, I warned my colleagues that if they pursued this false equity proposal, that would be the result. So a rather predictable disaster is occurring on campus. I do want to push back a little bit, though, on the assessment that it is.
So there's one example. It's happening across the United States. As a person who has taught on college campuses, you can see my video, Curricula Vitae. We posted it yesterday. I have interrelated with thousands and thousands and thousands of students, and it was wonderful to see the interest that students had in the educational process, critical learning, critical thinking. Every classroom I gave was a challenging classroom to get them to think. And I'm happy to have been a part of that. As of today, would I teach on a college campus? No. No, this is the college campus today. sharing ideas. We're going to go up today with hearing from Russ from New York. Hi, Russ. You're up. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. I'd just like to remind you that the landlords choked off all the businesses, and Gail Brewer sat by and did nothing about commercial rent control. But, Gary, you know, the power of the state in making us do things that are unnecessary is what these young people are following. Government control is their model. They see the only way to get things done is through violence. And I think, you know, they've been put into a corner, and I think you should really give them some slack. There's no time for dialogue. We've seen 10 years go by in progress in a few weeks because there's no dialoguing with liars and intellectually dishonest people. But I really like you, Gary. You're a great guy.
Okay, well, on that, you and I would share a different point of view. My point of view is it's only with dialogue that we can have a sustainable change. If you don't want dialogue, then you're going to go to the streets, and on the streets, in a heartbeat, it can go from peaceful, if you have agent provocateurs, if you have those who are there to intimidate the participants into committing an act that they normally would not. And it's very easy when you get people who are high up on their emotions to suddenly start screaming chants. A chant, a slogan, a euphemism is not a dialogue. When people turn their backs on you and give you the finger, that's not dialoguing. We're not going to change anything in America that's meaningful because people are in the streets. What we're going to do is we're going to have articles, documentaries, dialogues, and meetings with people from all walks of life. All walks of life, no one excluded, to share an opinion to see what is the problem in its entirety, not just some example. When someone comes to see me who has a problem, I don't look at the end stage symptom and start there. I look at the underlying cause of that and work from there to change the entire outcome of the body, not just an arthritic joint or not just a heart fibrillation or not just a dimension in the mind. I have to change everything in the body. So where the action is we've got a problem in one part of the body, why not help the whole body? So I'm saying that we've got to change the entire body politic. And to do that, you have to have responsible and reasonable minds sit together and say, where can we change this so that we no longer have a bad cop? Where can we change so we no longer have a landlord that is making the small businesses, pay for their property taxes? And how it works, everyone, is the landlord will have an appreciation over time in the value of the building. Let's say the building was worth $30 million. Now, 5 years later, it's worth $40 million. They'll immediately go to the bank and take out a $40 million mortgage, knowing that in 5 years, they'll take out a $45 or $50 million, and they use that for themselves. That means the poor businesses there have to pay for the landlord's taxes, the tenants pay for the rents, and so the landlord, in effect, has got a free ride. At the end of it, they may have a risk, and right now, with all the businesses closing, a lot of those landlords are going to not be able to refinance, and they won't be able to pay for the maintenance servicing their debt load, and they'll go broke. And buildings all over are going to go broke by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, by the millions. Nationwide homes and businesses are going to go broke and file bankruptcy. But how you change that problem is you have to recognize the people who were elected, like the Gail Brewers and others on the council, are not there to serve the interests of the small business nor the consumer. They're there based on who put money into their campaigns, the landlord. Who's one of the largest lobbies in New York? The landlords. I absolutely agree with you, Russ. You and I would agree on that. It's the landlords who's behind that. But that you don't get rid of the problem by just saying landlords are greedy. Yeah, we know that. You have to change the laws. And to change the laws, you have to get a person that's already accepted money and therefore is beholding to a landlord or their association. And to do that, you have to have a whole new generation. It's going to probably take 5 or 10 years to get new young people in who are not compromised, who have higher ideals, and are not just political hacks. You're looking for the American Legislative Exchange Council or some local group, special interest group, to put money into your campaign. And that's exactly what happens at the state level, that happens at the local level, and that happens certainly at the federal level. How do you think Nancy Pelosi became worth nearly $100 million? How do you think that any of these politicians ended up? They can engage in hidden stock trades because they're made aware of committee meetings, who's merging, and that what that's going to do to a potential valuable company. They buy ahead. You don't know that. If you and I had that information, we would go to jail for insider trading. They're allowed to do insider trading. They're allowed all of these culpable things that they're not held accountable for. Young people are not looking for at the government as the enemy. They're looking at as the savior. Hence, the younger people want mandatory vaccines. They want mandatory testing. They want everything because they trust in the government more than they do themselves or the outside sources. They're the first to attack all the people who refuse because of freedom of choice to want a vaccine. So you have to take that into account, that their parents taught them that, and then their peers taught them that. I'll do a commentary. I'll tell you what, Russ, for you, tonight I'll write a commentary. And it'll be a very deep one. And I'll write it and I'll present it on tomorrow's show. Thank you for your call, Russ. Have a nice day. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.